Today is Monday, September the 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. President Joe Biden says that the new Texas state law that bans abortion as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy is almost un-American.
The Texas law is enforced by authorizing private persons to bring lawsuits, not against the woman, but against anyone who's assisted the woman in obtaining the abortions.
Joe Richard Paul is a professor of law at the University of California Hastings Law School in Guinea-Conakry. An elite military unit takes power in what appears to be a coup against President Alpha Conde.
I was not surprised by this morning event because Guinea has been quite unstable recently, and a lot of people were suspecting that something might have to give.
And a delegation of top Lebanese interim government officials met with their Syrian counterparts in Damascus this past weekend. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And let's start off the show in the U.S. President Biden says that the failure by the U.S. Supreme Court to rule against the Texas law imposing a near total ban on abortion will cause unconstitutional chaos by infringing on the rights that women have exercised for decades. In Washington, the Biden administration and some legislators have expressed concern about the new law, saying that they're looking for ways on the federal level to help protect abortion rights for women. Professor Joe Richard Paul teaches constitutional law at the University of California Hastings Law School in San Francisco. He joins me via phone to explain what this law means to women's rights over their bodies and how the inaction by the Supreme Court opens the door for the other states to enact similar laws.
The Texas law is enforced by authorizing private persons to bring lawsuits, not against the woman, but against anyone who's assisted the woman in obtaining the abortion. So the doctor, the nurses, the Uber driver, the best friend who lent her the money. And that effectively means that it's almost impossible for any kind of abortion clinic to operate in the state of Texas now, because you simply have to have a suspicion that someone may have aborted a fetus after the 5-week period. And that's enough to file a lawsuit. So the abortion clinics will basically face an onslaught of lawsuits, and they'll have to constantly be defending themselves.
So what exactly did the court do or fail to do, and how does that and the particular Texas law threaten the long-standing Roe v. Wade?
The court in this case decided not to decide the case. So the court was basically asked to issue an injunction to stop the Texas law from going into effect. And the court took the view that we're not going to decide this now, we're going to wait till some later point in time. Now, the reason this is very troubling is that normally, if a state just outright said a doctor who performs an abortion is going to be subject to a fine, that would be violative of the Constitution. And the way in which Texas has tried to do an end run around the constitutional right is by authorizing a private person to bring a lawsuit that would otherwise be impossible for the state to bring. Because the Constitution only applies to what the state does, not what a private person does. Now, if the court allows this precedent to occur, it doesn't just threaten abortion rights. And this is the key point. It doesn't just threaten abortion rights because it means that any state can prohibit any constitutional right by simply allowing private persons to bring lawsuits against anyone who assists in the exercise of that right. So I'll give you an example. The state of California could decide to prohibit handguns. The Supreme Court has said handguns are a constitutional right. You have a constitutional right to possess a handgun. Mm-hmm. If California decides to prohibit handguns, it simply says, we're going to give any private person the right to bring a lawsuit against anyone who has a handgun, or anyone who sells them a handgun, or anyone who assists or has knowledge of their having a handgun. It makes a mockery of our Constitution, and it makes it impossible for anyone to exercise any constitutional rights if states can evade the Supreme Court's rulings by simply authorizing private persons to bring lawsuits.
Now, opponents of this Texas law say that it opens the door for other states to pursue abortion restrictions. What does this mean?
So there's two things that have been going on. One is that other states are trying to test whether or not there's now a majority on the court to reverse the Supreme Court's decisions in Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And so Mississippi, for example, has a case before the Supreme Court this fall, in which Mississippi has said that they're prohibiting abortions after 15 weeks. So that's before the point at which the fetus would typically be viable outside the womb, of 22 weeks. The Mississippi law is intended to try to see if the additions of Justices Kavanaugh and Justice Amy Coney Barrett on the court is enough to switch the balance in the court. I don't know whether that's going to happen. But in addition to that, now, if the Texas law goes ahead, other state legislators are also considering laws that would do the same thing, that would basically say we're going to let private persons bring lawsuits people who assist in abortions that occur even before the point of viability. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't say that any abortion is illegal in a state from the moment of conception, and anyone who assists in the abortion will be subject to this $10,000 fine. If this law is upheld in Texas, any other law that would outlaw abortion at any point in time would be permissible if you allow a private person to enforce the law.
That was Professor Joe Richards, who teaches constitutional law at the University of California Hastings Law School in San Francisco. Voice of America. A Guinean Americano announced on state television that President Alpha Conde's government, along with the constitution, have been dissolved. The announcement Sunday came after hours of heavy gunfire near the presidential palace in the capital of Conakry. Americano Mamadou Doumbouya, appearing on TV draped in Guinea's national flag and surrounded by eight other armed soldiers, said in a broadcast that the country's borders would be closed and that they are planning to form a transitional government. The mutinous soldiers, who call themselves the National Committee of Gathering and Development, did not provide details about the whereabouts of President Alpha Conde. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and the African Union have condemned the apparent coup, calling for the release of President Conde. Conde came into power in 2010 in the country's first democratic election since independence from France. Siba Grovogi is a Guinean professor of international relations theory and law at Cornell University in New York. He tells me that the situation as it stands is quite fluid, and it is hard to know who is actually holding power in Guinea. He starts off by giving us a little history of the previous military coups in his country.
In Guinea, the first coup d'etat was done by a man called Lansana Conte. He was from the coast. Okay. The second head of the military was actually from the rainforest, Moussa Dadis Camara. His stay was very short-lived. So the only military regime that mattered was that of Lansana Conte, which lasted 20 odd years. The other one just lasted a few, barely 2 years, and then it collapsed.
So, and then this one, today's?
Well, that is not clear yet, because we don't know, and this is what I was going to caution. The Ministry of Defense in Guinea has said that they still have troops on their side. The president of the parliament in Guinea is very connected to the military. So we have to see the evening go and for tomorrow morning to see what happens. So I'm not terribly convinced. These are special units. They're actually not the majority of the army. And they may be more better trained. They have better weapons, and they are in the capital city. But the main barracks, some of the main barracks in Guinea are actually outside of the capital city. And so we don't know yet. And I just want to caution.
Okay, so the situation is quite fluid. We don't know. There's a lot of unknowns right now. Were you surprised at this morning's events in the country?
Not entirely. I was not surprised by this morning event, because Guinea has been quite unstable recently, and a lot of people were suspecting that something might have to give.
What has the situation been in Guinea since the re-election of Conde last year, and what does this coup mean for the political stability of the country?
Well, let's go step by step. First of all, let me just say that since the Alpha Conde was re-elected after he changed the constitution, the country has not been stable because Guinea basically has two political blocks of more or less equal power, and both of them are fairly well organized in civil society. And so we had actually a very tense standoff and with no clear winner. And the only arbiter in this standoff was the military. And now, of course, the military seem to have decided to step in.
Who is Alpha Conde and what will his legacy be?
Alpha Conde was, he has a very storied political trajectory. When he lived in France, before immediately after our independences, he was the head of the Guinea Francophone African Students in France, so FEAF, Fédération Africaine des Étudiants d'Afrique Noire. And so that's how he made his political beginning. And then, of course, he was very tied to the French Socialist Party because he himself was in the Socialist International and this and that. So he came to Guinea politics very networked, mostly in France, but having very deep roots inside Guinea. And so people really had hoped that because he had presented himself as this guy who was fighting for multi-party democracy, when he was elected, people hoped that he would, in fact, bring about political pluralism. He will nurture democratic institutions, since we didn't have any before he came to power. Right? But by the time he came to power, he began to act like everybody else. And basically, my analysis, both as Guinean and as a political scientist, is to say that for 42 years, Alpha Conde had been fighting people to come to power. And my suspicion has always been, and I've said this multiple times, both in Guinea and outside of Guinea, that I always suspected that he was more comfortable fighting people than governing. Mm. And because for 42 years, that's his political muscles were all about fighting. So he ends up being very cynical, very antagonistic, and very suspicious of anybody. So at that level, he actually is not somebody who assembles people. He's more comfortable in the other role.
That was Professor Siba Grovogi, a professor of international relations at Cornell University in New York. In other news, in South Africa, the government's Correctional Services Department has placed jailed former President Jacob Zuma on medical parole because of ill health. Last month, prison authorities said Zuma, serving a 15-month sentence in Estcourt Prison for contempt of court, underwent unspecified surgery at an outside hospital where he had been sent for observation. And hundreds of thousands of farmers gathered in India's most popular state of Uttar Pradesh on Sunday, the biggest rally yet in a month-long series of demonstrations to press Narendra Modi's government to repeal three new agriculture laws. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. A delegation of top Lebanese interim government officials met with their Syrian counterparts in Damascus Saturday for the first time in nearly 10 years to discuss importing Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territory. The U.S. ambassador to Lebanon appeared to give a green light to such an arrangement last week. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Syrian state TV showed a smiling Foreign Minister Faisal al-Mikdad receiving Lebanon's Deputy Prime Minister Zaina Akar under a picture of President Bashar al-Assad and a Syrian flag. Arab media noted there was no sign of Lebanon's flag inside the room during the meeting. Arab media reported the U.S. ambassador to Beirut, Dorothy Shea, appeared to give a green light to the gathering between Lebanese interim government officials and their Syrian counterparts during a meeting she held with Lebanese President Michel Aoun at the end of last month. Nasri al-Houri, who heads the Joint Syrian-Lebanese Cooperation Commission, told journalists after the meeting at the Syrian Foreign Ministry that officials from both countries were eager to begin cooperating about delivering Egyptian natural gas and Jordanian electricity to Lebanon via Syria. He says both the Lebanese and Syrian delegations discussed the difficult situation which the two countries find themselves in, especially concerning electricity and gas. Al-Khoury asked Syria to help Beirut gain access to Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through its territory, which Damascus welcomed. Both sides will now examine the technical details of the agreement. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that Syria does not even have the technical facilities to carry out such a transfer of Egyptian gas, and that electricity lines from Jordan will cross Syrian territory around the southern city of Daraa, which is currently a war zone. Abu Diab went on to argue the decision to accept the agreement came from U.S. diplomacy, which he said is a bit unpredictable and filled with contradictions, especially regarding policy towards Syria. He says that before the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon agreed to the deal, Jordan's King Abdullah tried to lobby for such an agreement when he met U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House in July. Diab says Jordan is in a difficult economic position and wants to normalize relations with Syria, suggesting that any taxes taken by Syria be used for humanitarian purposes only. The leaders of Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq met in Baghdad in June to agree to an energy cooperation deal in which Egypt would send natural gas and electricity to both countries. Discussions at the time hinted at eventually expanding the deal to Syria and Lebanon. Syria, however, does not have the technical capabilities to carry Egyptian gas to Lebanon. Paul Sullivan, a Washington-based Middle East analyst, tells VOA that Saturday's agreement between Lebanon and Syria will make Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran more powerful in Lebanon, and they also bring more trouble to the country. One has to wonder, he says, if there isn't another way to get fuel to Lebanon without handing such power to such a malign actor. In a strange twist of fate, Iraqi TV reported that Iran cut gas shipments to Baghdad Saturday amid an ongoing spat over money Iraq owes Iran for energy shipments. Some reports say Baghdad is unwilling to pay Tehran due to U.S. economic sanctions on Iran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
With the last U.S. service members leaving Kabul, ending a 20-year war, Afghanistan's women and girls are facing the stark reality that the Taliban are back in control of their country. As VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports, there are already signs that their rights are in danger.
Taliban fighters celebrated with gunfire and swooped into the Kabul airport this week as the last U.S. service members left Afghanistan. For Afghan women, the U.S. departure marks a new era of uncertainty and fears of what lies ahead. The Taliban have promised women certain rights under the framework of Islam. However, basic rights like going to school or work could soon be taken away. In the western city of Herat, Afghan women staged a defiant protest, demanding the right to work and representation in the Taliban's new government. Lena Haidari is a government school teacher.
I want to say that I was forced to stay at home for the crime of being a student 20 years ago, and now, 20 years later, for the crime of being a teacher and a woman.
State Department spokesperson Ned Price had this to say.
What we will be looking to when it comes to the issues that you've raised, including the potential for any forms of assistance, will be the actions of any new Afghan government, especially vis-a-vis the areas we care profoundly about. That is safe passage, respect for the rights of the people of Afghanistan, including women and girls and minorities, a government that is inclusive.
U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen told a Washington Post forum this week that the Doha Agreement, negotiated between the Trump administration and the Taliban in 2020, provided no guarantees of an inclusive government or protections for the rights of women. Democratic United States Senator Jean Shaheen.
I raised concerns with former Secretary Pompeo, with Ambassador Khalilzad, that women were not represented at the table, despite the fact that we have legislation on the books signed by former President Trump that says in conflict areas, women should be at the negotiating table when we are negotiating the end to the dispute. And those messages fell on deaf ears. So now we are dealing with a situation where women and girls were not represented at the table, and there are no assurances for them going forward.
A former Afghan judge living in exile told that same forum what she is hearing from women activists still in Afghanistan.
They are depressed, they are helpless, they cannot help themselves, not only themselves, but also they become dependent. That's also a kind of a way of how they see themselves being independent woman, and all of a sudden entering to the situation where they have to be dependent to the male family members.
Many fear the Taliban will return to the brutal way they ruled the country from 1996 until the U.S. drove them out in 2001. Tara DeMont is with Amnesty International USA.
They banned almost all education for women and girls. They imposed punishments, including stoning and lashings. And they confined women to their homes unless they were accompanied by a male escort. And there's a real fear that this type of repression or versions of this could come back.
The very real threats to the lives of Afghan women activists demand action by the Biden administration. Tara DeMont of Amnesty International tells VOA.
For some Afghan women, for some Afghan women's rights defenders, safety is going to look like a refugee, being a refugee and being an asylum seeker in the United States or in other countries.
For now, many Afghan women are left to stay and fight for their rights with a fresh protest Friday in Kabul. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Opposition and rights activists in Tanzania have condemned the arrest of several members of the country's main opposition, Chadema Party, who were to hold a forum to discuss constitutional reforms. The action happened while Chadema leader Freeman Mbowe remains behind bars facing terrorism-related charges. His party has branded his jailing as a bid by President Samia Suluhu Hassan's government to silence the opposition. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
The condemnations came after police in Musoma, a town in Mara region in the northern part of Tanzania, Saturday, arrested 9 members of the main opposition Chadema party who were organizing a symposium on a new constitution. In a post shared on Twitter, the Chadema party said it was following the incident, which it said suppresses democracy. The statement said, "We strongly condemn this blatant violation of the Constitution and rule of law, sowing the seeds of hatred, discrimination, and discord within communities." It also protested against what the party called the suppression of democratic rights by police and other security forces. Speaking with VOA, Chadema party spokesperson Costa Zone, Gerva Lienda, says the ongoing unrest is motivated by their demand for a new constitution.
Kabla ya madai ya katiba mpya, kulikuwa hakuna hivi vitu.
Lenda says that before the demand for a new constitution, there were no arrests. He said the problem is a new constitution. It's their right and they will fight for it. Lenda added that Chadema would like to obtain a new constitution without bloodshed. Chadema is challenging the current constitution, which was formed under a single-party system, saying it favors the ruling Revolutionary Party. A government critic, such as Bob Wangwe, sees the arrests as suppressing democracy in Tanzania.
Jeshi la polisi linataka kufundisha wananchi.
He says the police forces want to control what citizens discuss and what they can do, while the Constitution of the United Republic of Tanzania grants citizens freedom and the right to discuss issues that concern them. He urged President Samia Hassan to take the issue seriously since it tarnishes the image of the country. Police declared the Chadema gathering on constitutional reform illegal and unconstitutional, pointing to Hassan's remark that it is time to build the economy first. Longinus Tibishubwam is the head of police in Mara region. Discussions about the constitution will be resumed after the economy becomes stable. When the president decides that the situation is good, then the symposium about the constitution will be given a permit, Tibishubwam says. He added that if there's anyone trying to hold a constitutional forum now, he sees them as breaking the law. Analysts say Hassan has started well, but incidents like these show some weakness. Victor Kweka is a political analyst. Kweka says there is no president who is perfect, but there are weaknesses that can be avoided. He added that if the president has good advisors, she can implement her duties in a way that will show that she really intends to have a national unit government and a country to stand together as one on economic, political, and democratic matters. Meanwhile, opposition in Tanzania is still insisting that they'll be continuing with their operation to exercise their democratic rights without fear for the state apparatus. For the president, building the economy is her first priority. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is appealing to nations to end COVID-19 border restrictions that keep Central American refugees from seeking asylum. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Forced displacement within Central America and Mexico has been soaring over the last 5 years. The United Nations Refugee Agency says factors, including chronic violence and insecurity, climate change, and natural disasters, have forced people to flee their homes in growing numbers. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterini Kitidi tells VOA the effects of COVID-19 and hurricanes Eta and Iota, which struck the region with devastating force last year, have triggered further large-scale displacement. In particular, she says these disasters have created great economic hardship for women and children who have lost their source of income and have difficulty obtaining basic services.
And as a result, such people are forcibly displaced, and they are compelled many times to embark to even further dangerous onward journeys where they are exposed to smugglers, traffickers, and to other risks, like, for example, sexual exploitation, abuse, or even murder.
Katidi says a staggering 1 million people from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras have been forced to flee their homes, creating an unprecedented displacement crisis in the region. Due to public health COVID-19 travel restrictions, she says Central American refugees face extreme difficulties in obtaining protections they need in countries of asylum. She says the UNHCR has appealed to the U.S. government to end the Title 42 public health-related asylum restrictions.
And under which we see the ports of entry to the United States remaining closed to most asylum seekers with exemptions for some categories of population with vulnerabilities. And we have asked for the expulsions that are occurring of these people to stop and for the right to claim asylum in the United States to be restored.
Katidi says all countries in the region have agreed to share the responsibility to provide protection for those fleeing danger and persecution. She adds discussions are continuing with regional authorities in the hopes they will live up to their agreement. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production crew here at The Voice of America, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very great week ahead.